Well, I pretty much avoided all of it. The Platinum Jubilee, obviously. In the end, it turned out to be pretty easy, really. I just avoided the main TV channels and only public places like parks or the local shopping centre for the 4 days of the Jubilee weekend, and I was able to pretend nothing was going on. There were no street parties in my area, at least none that I was invited to. I didn't wake up on the Sunday to find the road outside my house closed and trestle tables set up anyway, and no bunting, and only a few houses with flags or balloons outside. The plus side of it all was that the roads were pretty much empty, so on the Friday of that weekend, I was able to drive out to the country for a pleasant walk. I also took the opportunity to watch an eclectic mix of films with no Jubilee connection whatsoever. So you might say that I successfully returned the favour to Her Majesty by completely ignoring her big event the same way that she once ignored me. Now, I know that I've told this story before, but as I had to endure a weekend full of people telling their stories about how they met the Queen earlier this month, I'm going to retell my story about how I didn't meet her. We're going back more years than I care to remember. When I was working in London, it was during President Mandela's state visit, and I was walking down Whitehall one lunchtime when the Queen's limo, complete with police escort, drove past. Now, I was the only person on that side of the street as they came past. I could clearly see Her Maj and Nelson Mandela on the back seat, and they saw me. Indeed, Nelson Mandela waved at me, and I waved back. But do you know what? Not only did the Queen not acknowledge me, at the time one of her civil servants, incidentally, but she actually turned and looked the other way, to the opposite side of the street, where there was no one. I've never forgotten that slight. Friggin' outrageous. So instead of getting involved in protests or attempting to disrupt events, I decided to simply to ignore the Platinum Jubilee as retaliation, just as I did the Golden and Diamond Jubilees. Which brings me to a more serious point. How many more of these bloody events are we, the public, expected to finance? Because make no mistake about it, it's the taxpayer who has footed the bill for four of these jubilees in the past 45 years. I'm not going to say that it's obscene that public money is being spent on celebrating an overprivileged hereditary elite. I mean, obscene is a word both overused and misused these days. But it is perplexing that our governments are willing to sanction such expenditures where we have increasing levels of poverty in this country, especially right now when we're in a cost of living crisis, with increasing prices making it increasingly difficult for even those employed in relatively well-paid jobs to afford basics like food and fuel. But of course, this spectacle of those 4 days, the press told me it's a spectacle, I didn't see it, so I'll have to take their word for it, was undoubtedly meant to divert our attention from the various crises engulfing the country, in particular the crises engulfing Boris Johnson. Sadly, with that vote of no confidence against him directly after the Jubilee weekend having failed, I'll just have to sustain myself for the time being with my fantasies of seeing him bludgeoned to death by an angry mob on the steps of Parliament. Until his inevitable fall in reality, that is. The silver lining of him surviving that vote was that he stays in charge and drags the Tories into further into the mire, effectively destroying their chances at the next election. Sadly, though, a lot of people will have to suffer in the meantime. Getting back to the Platinum Jubilee, if anybody asks me, I can honestly say that I enjoy the Jubilee weekend. I didn't see any of the event myself, but I enjoyed not seeing it and doing other stuff instead.
It could be you. A chance meeting on a lonely country road. A pretty girl, a good-looking guy. She's Ginny. He's Mike Beresford, successful songwriter. They met and they fell in love. Everything seems so right.
I wonder.
Come on, I bet you say that to all the girls.
You fancy a cocktail?
How would you guess it could lead to a whole lot of trouble?
So what do you do, Jenny?
I'm into fashion.
Great looking shoes. You want to take care of her.
A bittersweet love affair set against the background of the rock music scene. The glitter, the high life, then disaster.
What's the problem, for God's sake?
This, Ginny, it's illegal.
All right, get to the point.
Suddenly you find your friends desert you.
He wants you to keep low profile.
You're terrific. Thanks for nothing.
You've always been against me.
Even your family.
You know, I don't believe it. Suddenly no one's speaking to me anymore.
I gotta go!
Look, I've never forced you to do anything.
I gotta go!
Just a minute.
No!
Ginny, please!
Michael Edward Vanishman?
Yes?
I'm Detective Inspector Grace, honey. We have a word with you?
It's no good, Dad. I love him. You leave me.
Go home before midnight. Home before midnight. A love story that could happen to you and a tragedy you couldn't avoid. Home before midnight. It's time for love.
We live in an age where the strangest things in TV terms seem to happen. One of the streaming channels I get via my Roku box, for instance, recently showed a double bill of Alice and Elliot movies. Pete Walker's Home Before Midnight, made in 1979, and the notorious proto-slasher Killer's Moon from 1978, which is directed by Alan Berkenshaw. At least I assume it was a double bill of her movies, as she was the only common cast member between the two, as far as I could see. Then again, it could have been a double bill of 70s low-budget exploitation movies, or even a double bill of British movies highlighting a more than slightly disturbing attitude to rape, which lingers in the UK to this day. Or perhaps it was just coincidence that she was in both films. To get the obvious out of the way, if you aren't familiar with Alice and Elliot, and there's no reason why you should be, she is one of those young British actresses of the 70s and 80s who gained a certain cult fame from appearing in a few low-budget sexploitation titles before seemingly vanishing. Elliot is interesting because, apart from her starring roles in the two aforementioned titles in her late teens, she subsequently had a number of prominent roles on TV before falling off the radar in the mid-80s. My best guess would be that she took a career break to start a family and never got back into the business, or simply tired of it all and decided to do something more sensible than acting for a living. Home Before Midnight represented something of a return to his sexploitation roots for Pete Walker after his long series of horror films. It tries to have its cake and eat it by presenting itself as a serious exploration of the issues and moral questions surrounding statutory rape and underage sex, while also providing the viewer with plenty of sex and nudity. The plot involves a popular and successful songwriter who picks up a girl in a rainstorm with the best of intentions but proceeds to have a sexual relationship with her before finding out that she's only 14. Now, despite this, he continues with the relationship until it's uncovered and finds himself facing rape charges. Much is then made of the fact that, initially, he thought she was older, which he might be forgiven for, as Alison Elliott was 18 or 19 when she played the role of the girl, and she looked it. And that is implied makes it okay. The problem with the film is that, as far as I'm aware, unlike some US states, the UK doesn't actually have an offence of statutory rape. As it was always clear that the girl consented to sex, the issue would be whether that consent was legal as she was underage, meaning that the main charge he would have been facing, I think, and I'm not an expert on sexual offences, thankfully, the main charge would be sex with a minor, of which he is eventually convicted, and he's obviously guilty. Well, bringing in the rape charge places the main character in greater jeopardy for the sake of drama. It is simply unrealistic. Regardless, the film still seems to think that he has been unfairly treated for being sent down for having his life ruined for having sex with a schoolgirl. These days, of course, as someone prominent in the entertainment industry, he'd probably find himself facing a major investigation accused of grooming and paedophilia. With good cause. Despite the underlying attitudes of the film, it actually isn't normal for adult males to want to have sex with children, even if they do look older and continue to do so when you've established that they are in fact underage is indefensible. and I'm sorry to sound so moralistic, but somebody trained as a teacher, this is an issue I've had to consider very carefully. I know that teenage girls under 16 can sometimes look much older, but the onus is still on any adult encountering them to establish their true age before getting intimate with them. It's not difficult, guys. Another problematic aspect of the film is that, although they are played by young adult actresses, it presents Elliot and her friend, played by the ill-fated former Page 3 girl Debbie Lyndon, as 14-year-olds, making their multiple full-frontal nude scenes uncomfortable, to say the least. Of course, that's partly the point, to make the viewer complicit with the underlying theme of the sexualisation of underage girls by contemporary society, but it also feels cynical and exploitative. The proverbial having its cake and eating it I referred to earlier. Whatever one might think of its implicit attitudes to rape and to underage sex, like all Pete Walker films, Home Before Midnight is actually very well made, with the director eliciting good performances from his cast and making excellent use of his limited resources with lots of well-shot location work. Walker might have been an exploitation director, but he's also a professional filmmaker, and it always shows. The Walker film at least accepts that rape and underage sex are considered serious issues by both the law and society, which is more than can be said for Killer's Moon.
You may think they've made all the terror films they can make. You may think you've seen the most evil side of man, but you're wrong. For what people do in their dreams is far more horrible than anything they do while awake. Killer's Moon is the story of a party of young girls stranded on a school outing, and four psychopaths undergoing dream therapy have escaped. What follows is a nightmare, more terrifying than anything you've ever dreamed.
There were three of them. They wore white clothes like surgeons. Her eyes were staring.
5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, one's missing. Yeah, I believe Sandra's in the kitchen helping the cook.
Agatha tried to help her friends escape. But she didn't realize the kind of men she was up against, and the dreamer wasn't as sympathetic as she'd hoped. You'll keep praying the terror will stop, but these men can't stop. They have to go on because they think it's part of their treatment. Deirdre thought she could go for help.
Can't escape, Dream. Not now.
But dreamers have a way of seeing through the night. Stories have been told about the abnormal, about the supernatural.
Men, horrible men, they've killed Mrs. Hargreaves. Lock the door!
But this is the story of what can happen when hallucinatory drugs get hold of the mind. Anybody's mind.
Quick, come on, girls!
I'll get you!
And when minds are taken over, the results aren't always the fun people imagine.
I'm going to kill you. Slowly.
It has to be a dream!
Most of us only glimpse our primitive selves in our dreams. If you don't want to be reminded of what you could be, we suggest you stay home in bed.
The film, which features a number of schoolgirls being raped by a gang of maniacs, at least shows it as a horrific trauma for their victim, but then undermines with a bizarre piece of dialogue which seemingly dismisses rape as being relatively trivial. Look, you were only raped. As long as you don't tell anybody about it, you'll be all right. You pretend it never happened. I pretend I never saw. And if we ever get out of this alive, well, maybe we'll both live to be wives and mothers, a girl tells a friend who's just been raped. Perhaps most astoundingly, novelist Faye Weldon, half-sister of the director, later claimed to have rewritten the dialogue for the film, uncredited, so presumably she must take responsibility for this line. Even more incredibly, she professed being proud of her work on the script, which she thought was too good for the film.
To be absolutely fair, the dialogue, that dialogue and the whole rape business are only part of the problems afflicting Killer's Moon. A lot of people have written reams about Killer's Moon, so I'll try to be brief. But its fundamental problem is its lack of style and purpose. A brief synopsis of the scenario, a quartet of psychos escape from a secure psychiatric cottage hospital, who, as a result of drug therapy, believe they're in a dream where their actions have no consequences, at the same time that a coach carrying a group of schoolgirl choristers has broken down nearby, a night of terror ensues. See, this makes it sound as if it was conceived as some sort of parody, except that it isn't. It is apparently intended as a serious shocker. But even there it fails. The killings are decidedly short on blood and gore, and the suspense non-existent. The dialogue is, for the most part, repetitious, with the whole "we're in a dream" business seeming repeated in every other line. The acting is highly variable, and the plot consists of far too much running around in either the woods with murky day-for-night shooting, or the hotel where the girls have taken refuge. Add some animal cruelty, a dog has its leg chopped off screen, and a cat has its tail cut off, to the multiple schoolgirl rapes and the somewhat offensive depictions of mental health, and you have what critic Matthew Sweet once referred to as the most tasteless movie in British cinema history. Now, to be fair, I'm sure I've seen worse, and personally I found the film less offensive than simply inept. But getting back to the point, the whole thing is flatly directed and drags badly in the middle. Still, the Lake District locations look good. Frustratingly, like a lot of low-budget movies, you can't help but feel that Killer's Moon had the germ of a decent idea in the experimental drug therapy angle, but threw it away as a plot device rather than exploring it. Ultimately, it falls into that category of a bad movie that isn't even bad enough to be really funny. Sure, it's full of ludicrous dialogue and scenarios that seem as if they should be laughable, but they are handled so poorly that even unintended humour is drained from them. And it just comes over, ultimately, as tasteless. I feel I should add that, despite the depictions of animal abuse, no animals were actually harmed in the making of Killer's Moon. The cat already had no tail, and the three-legged dog had actually lost its leg while heroically tackling armed robbers in its home. It won the animal equivalent of a VC for its valour. The dog also gets its revenge in possibly the only scene that made me laugh, so ineptly was it staged, when it attacks its mutilator, tearing his throat out. But there you go.
Take a ride on the Devil's Express. What happens when 2,000 years of evil strike a city? See Warhawk Tanzania match blows with the devil and those the devil has possessed.
Some deformed monster.
Take a ride on the Devil's Express. It may be your last stop. Rated R.
An undeservedly obscure blaxploitation stroke kung fu stroke horror crossover, Devil's Express, 1976, also known by the more mundane title of Gang War, stars the magnificently named, not to mention coiffured, Warhawk Tanzania as a Harlem martial arts guru who finds himself involved not just in gang warfare, but also tangling with an honest-to-goodness demon into the bargain. In spite of a low budget, Devil's Express is a surprisingly slick-looking production, shot on location in New York, giving it plenty of local atmosphere and a realistic sheen. The effects are cheap, as to be expected, but reasonably effective. Even the demon, when it's finally revealed, isn't too badly realised, looking a lot better than many other low-budget movie monsters of the era. The film's main problem is its lack of narrative focus, as it meanders between the subplots, with the gang war aspect taking centre stage for large stretches of the narrative, and the police investigation into a series of gory murders on the subways pushed into the background into the latter stages of the film, with Warhawk Tanzania virtually vanishing for long stretches. This meandering is characteristic of the film as a whole. We kick off in ancient China with a group of monks sealing something into a well before killing themselves, before jumping forward to present day, well, 1976, New York, where Tanzania's Luke Curtis is taking local cop Chris, played by Larry Fleischman, through a martial arts lesson and vehemently resisting the latter's attempts to recruit his assistance in dealing with local gang violence. Next thing, we're back in China, but in the present day, where Luke and another of his pupils, Rodan, played by Wilfredo Roldan, is attending some kind of martial arts training retreat. Before you know it, Rodan has stumbled on the well and stolen an amulet buried there. Inevitably, this reawakens the demon sealed in there, who follows them back to New York by taking over the body of a passenger about to board a US-bound ship. Back in the Big Apple, Rodan and his gang get involved in a drug deal gone bad with some local Chinese guys, which erupts into full-fledged gang warfare between black and Chinese gangs. With the amulet in his possession, Rodan suddenly finds himself possessed of a new, murderous power that allows him to brutally and bloodily dispatch opponents. The demon, meanwhile, is decamped to the New York subway, gorily shredding his human host, where he starts tearing apart unwary victims as he searches for his amulet. The police investigation, led by Chris, runs into a brick wall and Rodan inevitably ends up in the subway facing the demon. Luke, having learned from a Chinese priest that this demon needs the amulet in order to regain its full powers, I mean without it, the demon couldn't stand daylight, hence it's lurking in the subway. And so he goes into the tunnels to avenge Rodan and get the amulet back. Incredibly, for such a crowded plotline, the film clocks in at only 83 minutes. At times it feels as if there are several different films playing out simultaneously until it finally all comes together in the last act. Yet despite all of the competing plot elements, Devil's Express could never really be described as fast-paced. Well, it never really feels slow. The film is punctuated by sequences that feel like asides from its main thrust. A scene in a bar that culminates in a brawl unrelated to the plot, or Chris's new partner's various ruminations on the nature of whatever is killing people on the subway, or even Luke's hookup with his woman, for instance. But they do all add lots of pleasing local colour and character to the film. Watching the film, one can't help but be struck by a persistent feeling that its loose structure is the result of the makers being unable or unwilling to properly flesh out its one original aspect, the demon on the subway. As it stands, it's a slim idea that often feels at odds with the greater realism of the gang war subplot, the police investigation and the whole gritty on the streets feel. It might well be that the only way the film could be financed is by emphasising these aspects of the movie. Indeed, the alternative title of Gang War and the associated trailer with that title that doesn't even feature the demon suggests that distributors had no faith in the supernatural aspect as a selling point. Or it could be that the supernatural element was added in almost as an afterthought in order to try and distinguish what would otherwise have been a routine plot from countless similar low-budget pictures. Barry Rosen's direction, if not inspired, is efficient, making excellent use of the New York locations and keeps things moving in the right direction. I mean, he later found success as a TV producer rather than as a director. Performances are highly variable, with the supporting players generally faring best. Wilfredo Roldan, for instance, is superbly scuzzy as Rodan, to the point that you are left wondering why Luke chose him of all his pupils to take to China, the man such a liability. While Stephen DeFazio is memorable as Chris's sidekick, forever weaving bizarre theories about the subway killings. Star Warhawk Tanzania is, it has to be said, fairly wooden in many scenes, which is perhaps why his screen time is limited, despite his top billing. What he does have, however, is an undeniable screen presence, cutting an imposing figure in every scene in which he appears. Damn it, he even gets away with kung fu fighting while wearing the most amazing pair of gold flares. Interestingly, although having screen presence and obvious martial arts prowess, I can find only one other screen credit for Tanzania, for 1975's Force 5. He seems to have vanished in the scene after Devil's Express, perhaps a victim of the fact that his only two films came late in both the blaxploitation and kung fu cycles, restricting further opportunities. The film does have some negatives when seen from a modern perspective, of course, principally the stereotypical portrayals of Chinese characters. But hey, it was 1976, and that was par for the course then. But this aside, Devil's Express is actually a lot of fun to watch. It might well meander all over the place at times, but often wanders into some pleasingly surprising developments. The climactic confrontation between Luke and the demon, for instance, isn't simply the physical kung fu fight one might expect, instead encompassing the demon's use of illusion to give it a spiritual aspect too. If nothing else, the film captures something of the ambiance of 70s New York, presenting the viewer with a satisfying time capsule of the era. An eccentric piece that never quite settles into being truly blaxploitation, martial arts or horror, and never really completely combining these elements in an entirely satisfactory manner. Devil's Express is nonetheless well worth seeking out. Its attempts to effectively juxtapose its main elements is ultimately what makes it so fascinating and enjoyable. And as a final thought, do you know what I was left wondering? Whether to Warhawk Tanzania, because that's clearly not his name, his real name. Had he originally been called Warhawk Tanganyika Zanzibar, perhaps? Who knows?
Meet Felicity. She's the world's cheekiest, spunkiest, sexiest new girl, and she's got a story to tell you. Come with Felicity as she takes you to Hong Kong and a very different world of sights that a tourist never sees.
What is this place?
Don't be afraid. We're going to take a bath like you never had before.
Felicity and her beautiful Asian friend will take you into a world of oriental bathhouses and softly scented delights, and in among the junk people, the bars, and the sometimes seamier side of life in their quest for pleasure. Felicity finds love in the strangest places and always plenty of volunteers to teach her more.
I want us to make love together.
She realizes from the beginning that there's more to love than meets the eye. And you'll realize there's more to Felicity than meets the eye too.
What are you wearing under that dress?
Just suspenders and panties.
Take them off.
It's not actually what she does that's very different, but it's just where she does it that's eye-popping.
Aren't you gay?
You mean here?
Why not let Felicity do it for you?
Another piece of disgusting filth I recently saw, more or less, in full on one of those dodgy streaming channels I watch. They were experiencing server problems at the time, so it jumped around and buffered a lot. I really must stop habituating such cesspools of sin. Actually, Felicity from 1978 is pretty harmless by anyone's standards. An Australian cash-in on Emmanuel, it is shot in the same glossy style, looking as if someone has smeared Vaseline all over the camera lens. It also takes the same sort of arty and tasteful approach to its subject matter, with all the sex, and there's a lot of it packed into 90-odd minutes, portrayed very decorously, with lots of silk sheets and discreet moaning. I challenge anybody to find this aspect of the film remotely offensive. What some modern viewers might find offensive, however, the stereotypical portrayal of Asians as variously inscrutable and or devious, not to mention all the usual stuff about the mysterious erotic practices of the East, known only to enigmatic high-class prostitutes. But hey, it was the late 70s and that sort of stuff was still current then. The plot concerns the titular character, one of those late 20s schoolgirls so prevalent in 70s and 80s porn movies, experiencing her sexual awakening while staying with her father's friends in Hong Kong during the school holidays. After being deflowered on the bonnet of an MGB by the regulation 70s mustachioed older cad, I mean, it could have been worse, could be in the back seat of a Volkswagen. She is introduced to the secrets of Oriental sexual pleasures by the obligatory high-class working girl. After various sexual escapades, all very tastefully filmed, she eventually finds happiness with an Australian guy, played by the original Philip Martin from Neighbours, who saves her from being mugged by one of those devious Asian guys. As already noted, the film packs a lot into its running time, moving from the obligatory school changing room and shower scenes for the schoolgirl fetishists to the erotic eroticism of the Far East, taking in some voyeurism and underwear fetishism along the way. There's even a flashback to a very mild lesbian encounter with a school friend. So it really does have something for everyone, but presented in the most inoffensive style possible. The film was sufficiently successful that a sequel was mooted, but this never materialised. As it stands, Felicity is actually a very enjoyable artefact of 70s erotica, a throwback to that time when cinematic porn became semi-respectable and started showing in mainstream cinemas to middle-class audiences. Indeed, the trailer for Felicity goes out of its way to emphasise the film's classiness, avoiding any nudity or actual sex scenes. It was clearly designed to play during showings of mainstream movies and appeal to a more upmarket audience than the usual dirty raincoat brigade. It's all helped immeasurably by an enormously likeable performance from the Canadian actress Gloria Annan in the title role, who takes for a genuinely engaging heroine in, as I say, what turns out to be, as I say, a surprisingly likeable and enjoyable romp.
He discovered a gas that increases the rate of neuron depletion.
You see, neurons begin dying off in everyone over the age of 25, and that's when this gas gets them. It causes death from instant old age.
First, I'm the oldest.
Michael.
You're first, Shorty.
This is none of your business.
I'm the... I should have something to say.
Oh, when the morning sun came pouring down like a golden rain, I looked at you and then I knew my life was gonna change.
I'm not Godhead. Will the real God please play something for me?
This is the real God speaking. Will the owner of the dark blue Mustang convertible, license number TUV525, please turn off your parking lot?
Why don't you make up a beautiful word for lovemaking?
Rainy day. Deferment.
Father, I have to know, is police brutality really a sin?
Only on Friday. Sorry, you little wildcat!
Marissa, are you pregnant or something?
Yes.
Since when?
Since Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels played the Astrodome.
I'm a Texas Ranger. Remember, we always get our man.
No, that's the Mounties.
We don't like your type in these parts, kid. Dirty, unwashed, hippie anarchists coming into Texas.
Texas, man, this is New Mexico.
No wonder I feel so ineffectual. I'm out of my natural environment.
I feel a sign coming on.
That was a hell of a sign.
I was back in the 60s again the other weekend, Most specifically, that bit near the end of the decade when, in the wake of the Beatles releasing Sgt. Pepper, everything went weird and psychedelic, and Hollywood started greenlighting films that most certainly wouldn't have been made at any other time. Actually, I say the 60s, but the film that set off this train of thought, Roger Corman's Gas, or It Became Necessary to Destroy the World in Order to Save It, which is usually given a production date of 1970, arrived just too late for the party, as it finally got a full release in 1971. Knowing this makes its channeling of the essence of the 60s counterculture, from its animated titles to its meandering road trip format to its anything goes freaked out finale, seem even more jarring than things normally do when viewed at a distance of half a century or so. Because it is so psychedelic 60s that it feels as if it's come from another reality, let alone a different decade. Corman throws in every late 60s stereotype imaginable. Hippies, peaceniks, bikers, youth culture, free love, the breakdown of capitalist society. He even adds in some of his own stereotypes. Edgar Allan Poe roars around on a motorbike, raving on his shoulder and Lenora on the pillion, commenting on the action. It all makes the film not just disjointed, but also very hit and miss. The basic idea of an escape of gas from a military base which results in everyone over 25 dying seems a promising start for a satire on youth culture. But the film never pursues this in a coherent plot, unlike the thematically similar Wild in the Streets, made in 1968 for instance, instead opting for an episodic structure centred on a road trip. The episodes focus on the main characters' encounters with the various new social groups that have sprung up in the aftermath of the gas leak. Well, some of these, like the biker gang turned golf club committee episode, more or less succeed in their satire. Others, particularly the college football team turned brigands episode, quickly become tiresome. It has to be said that, on a technical level, Gas looks great for such a low-budget movie, with superb photography and inventive use of locations. Even the performances from a largely unfamiliar cast, although it does feature an early performance from Ben Vereen, aren't distractingly flat, as is often the case in such situations. But it just doesn't hold together, either as a film, satire, or political statement, as most films of this type in the era inevitably were. According to Corman, the problem lay with the cuts made to the film distributors AIP, who used to be his last collaboration with the company, which robbed the film of coherence. This, of course, was denied by AIP, which pointed out that the editors they used had been approved by Corman and had worked with him in the past, but had trouble putting the footage together in any coherent way. Whatever the case, the film's sub-90-minute running time certainly suggests that cuts were made. Corman's complaints mainly focused on the way in which the film's climax had been edited, with his original shot, which he claimed would have given the film a better sense of conclusion, cut completely. To be fair, the film as released does feel as if it simply runs out of ideas, culminating with a weird sequence in which just about everyone the main characters have met in the course of the movie climb out of a hole in the ground before a truck drives up and various dead counterculture icons, including Martin Luther King, JFK and Che, climb out. Actually, it isn't so much that these icons emerge, but rather people wearing some not very good papier-mâché heads in their likeness. Apparently it's some kind of divine intervention by God himself. His voice is heard here and at previous points in the film. As I say, all typically 60s, and one can't help but feel if Gas had actually been released in the 60s, it might have been a box office success with its freewheeling plot and surreal incident. Indeed, I couldn't help but compare it to another quintessentially 60s film, Roger Marquand's Candy from 1968, which had enjoyed some success on its release, helped no doubt by being based on the best-selling novel of the same name. Now, by sheer coincidence, I caught Candy on the Shout Cult Cut streaming service, which I no longer have access to, the day after watching Gas, and it struck me how similar the films were. It wasn't just that both are structured as picaresque movies, with their main protagonists on a journey through a psychedelic landscape they struggle to understand, encountering various eccentric characters along the way. No, the climaxes of both films bear a striking resemblance to each other as well, with Candy ending with the titular heroine climbing out of a hole and encountering all of the characters she's previously interacted with throughout the film. This might also be taken as divine intervention, as her emergence in the hole was the result of the collapse of an underground temple, where she has just unwittingly had an implied sexual encounter with her own father. Not that I think Gas was a conscious imitation or parody of Candy, just that both films were so typical of that era, embodying the same ideas and sensibilities, so naturally tended towards similar formats. It's just that one of them had the good fortune to actually be released while the 60s were still swinging, while the other missed the mark and found itself beached and stranded in a very different era, unsympathetic to its ideas.
I believe in those who are free enough to give.
Ah, yes, to give. But what?
To give myself.
But to what?
To whatever needs me.
What in heaven's name are you talking about?
Depravity.
I don't know what that means.
Indecency.
Need. In and out.
Tell it like it is, baby.
I celebrate the virtue, the beauty, the wonder
of my fractured spleens, old, lymph-drained, liquid lust.
Gosh,
isn't the half of it.
Strip down. Slip out of your things.
We must find that place, right out, which we call the center of all breath.
My lungs?
Oh, no, it is not that simple. But now, could it be here? No, I do not think so. Perhaps it is here.
No, I think, I mean, it seems to me it couldn't be there.
I think it is. So soon, we found it so soon.
By God, what kind of people are you?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Lie down!
Well, all right.
We're going in all the way. By God. If that doesn't make you proud to be an American.
I beg your pardon.
What I'm saying, mister, is...
Bend forward slowly.
Aren't you even going to tell me your name?
Navarre Smite, Brigadier General, United States Special Reconnaissance Tactical Paratroop Command. Spec Rec Tac Paracom. Now let's talk turkey. Some of us haven't had time for the nice, soft, easy life. You understand? Some of us haven't had much dolce in our vitas.
How can I help?
Give me one little...
This man wet his pants.
I don't care about that.
What?
I need you now.
Manuel, he give himself.
Yes, now.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
Now!
Now! Now!
Now!
Now!
Now!
Now! Now!
Revolution! Viva Zapata!
Well, you don't know what we can find. Why don't you come with me, little girl? Carpet ride. Well, close your eyes, girl. Look inside, girl. Let the sound take you away.
Good grief, it's...
Candy.
It is a holy name.
Candy. Is Candy faithful?
Only to the book.
Clearly, I'm going to have to put up a notice on my front door saying something along the lines of no charity cold callers. I had another one the other day, ambushing me on my doorstep and attempting to inveigle me, into making some kind of financial commitment to their cause. It's always the same. The spiel about those poor orphan kittens from Romania, or whatever, whose lives would be improved if you could just pledge a modest 200 quid a week to their charity. Obviously designed to tug on your heartstrings and shame you into contributing, as apparently all your neighbours have already signed up. I mean, you wouldn't want to be that mean bastard who said no to such a deserving cause, would you? Well, I have no qualms about saying no. From a purely practical perspective, I simply can't afford to support all of these causes, regardless of how worthy they are. I mean, after all, I'm not actually working these days. I'm coasting along courtesy of my disgustingly healthy finances, courtesy of years of being a skinflint, till a couple of work pensions kick in or I'm offered some kind of employment I like the look of. More than that, though, I just don't like the emotional manipulation, let alone all that fake friendliness as they try to establish a connection with you. And I always make the latter as difficult as possible with a series of monosyllabic negative answers to such inquiries as to whether I have children, a wife, a dog or whatever. And I tell you something, I do this even if I did have any of those things. It denies them any kind of opening. I try not to be outright rude. I mean, I've spent far too many years myself knocking on doors, trying to enforce civil orders, receiving a fair amount of abuse, hostility and threats, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone. Still, I guess it was my fault for answering the door. I really should know by now that no legitimate callers ever knock on the door at 3:30 in the afternoon. Most people are at work or getting their kids from school at that time. I suppose it's one of the perils of being a man of leisure. I'm often at home during the day, particularly in the late afternoon, to fall prey to the cold callers. But it comes to something when a man can't lounge on his sofa, half watching William Shatner making clear that he thinks all the paranormal explanations in Weird or What are utter bollocks, and that the people advocating them are nut jobs, his words, not mine, while idly contemplating going out and putting some overpriced diesel in his car, without having someone try to shame him into giving to charity. I suppose that it could have been worse. It could have been one of those fast food couriers who's got the wrong address. This happens frequently to me, despite telling them that not only haven't I ordered anything, but I never use the likes of Deliveroo. I mean, for God's sake, most of the fast food joints in this town are within 5 or 10 minutes walk of me. I inevitably have to waste time arguing with them, as they insist they have the correct address. Often the problem lies with the fact that there's a similarly named road a few streets away, and the address has been taken down wrongly. Often the problem is that there are several properties divided into flats on my street, and the delivery is actually for flat one of these. Because I live at number one on my road, they come here, despite the fact this is clearly a terraced house, not a flat. Actually, even worse than those guys, now I come to think of it, are the parcel delivery guys trying to deliver stuff to people who have never lived at this address. Again, somebody has taken it down incorrectly. I've known some of them get quite aggressive about my refusal to take stuff I've not ordered. Even worse is when they've left it with one of the neighbours and I refuse to accept the delivery. I'd like to say that these sorts of things enliven my day, except they don't. It's got to the stage that I'm seriously contemplating not answering the door at all if I'm not actually expecting someone. I mean, that will show them. Oh, God, not again.